she has published some of the most extraordinary articles about the UFO phenomenon in the mainstream press that have ever been done. She publishes in newspapers and magazines around the world, including the Boston Globe, the Baltimore Sun, the Providence Journal, the New York Star Ledger, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the Nation, the International Herald Tribune, the Sydney Morning Herald, the Bangkok Post. The list is long. And she is also a contributing producer for an investigative news program on KPFA Radio in San Francisco. Her essays appear in Drugs, Society, and Behavior, in The Struggle for Democracy, Freedom, and Dignity. She is widely, widely published and has also accomplished more, I think, in straightforward and correct reporting of UFO phenomena than anyone ever in the history of UFO journalism, such as it is. And in that area, there are only two or three people now who really stand out as experts. Leslie Kane leads them. And today we're going to be talking to her about the inside story of things like Governor Fife Symington of Arizona, because she is the person who actually wrote the first stories about Fife Symington's change of position, really. He was debunking the Phoenix Lights. Now he says he saw not the lights, but the most controversial and extraordinary of all of the phenomena, the Black Triangle. So, Leslie, welcome to the show.
Well, Whitley, thank you, and that's quite an introduction. I really appreciate that.
Well, I'm glad. And let's begin by talking about you and where you started with this, because it's been a few years that we've known each other. And why did you start getting involved in, of all things, the dangerous things for a reporter to even write about, UFO phenomena?
Well, you're right. I actually, Whitley, I got involved in 1999, and I believe that you and I probably met right around that time, or in 2000, which was when actually my first UFO story came out in the year 2000. It was a story in the Boston Globe, a long investigative piece around the Cometa Report. You know, the French study about UFOs came out. And that's really how I got involved. I mean, for many years prior to that, I was a regular normal investigative reporter, although I did work for a fairly radical radio station called KPFA. But I had covered a wide range of subjects and all kinds of news stories and published in a lot of papers as a freelancer. So I already had a network of editors at various newspapers, particularly at the Boston Globe, that really liked my work, that trusted me as a good journalist. And it was because I had that door had already been opened to me, that when I finally came across this Cometa report, which was just sent to me by a colleague in France, and he said, you know, take a look at this.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about what it was, since it's been since 1999. But it's a very, very important document. And
very, very important.
Right.
I mean, I was absolutely blown away from, you know, really because of who wrote it. It was written by a group of 13 individuals. There are probably four or five generals, some of them four stars. There was a admiral in the group. They were mainly retired military. There was a government agency that studies UFOs. They contributed to it. Scientists, engineers. But the most impressive thing was, and also the retired head of the equivalent of NASA in France. These people were still active, but they weren't officially representing the government. But so they did this three-year study of all the UFO data from around the world, and they only looked at official data and pilot studies. It was not the guy on the street. This was government documents and pilot reports of sightings from all over the world. And after 3 years that all these people studied the data, they wrote a 90-page report, and it's called UFOs, What Are We Prepared For, I guess. And it was really from a national security perspective. And they came. What was really startling about the report, and the whole thing is really fascinating to read, but was that they came to the conclusion that the best hypothesis to explain what they had studied was the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And they actually put that out in black and white. And based on their conclusion of that fact, they did a lot of analysis about what this could mean, how it could affect society, what we need to do in terms of preparing for it, you know, preparing our military not to you know, not to try and shoot these things down, which is a big concern. So, I mean, what was really astounding was that a group of this caliber and this stature made a statement that they believed that the best hypothesis was the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And as a journalist, I recognized, my God, this is newsy. This is a news story. I mean, how could any journalist look at that and not recognize that?
And yet,
you know, these are generals and admirals saying this.
But Leslie, and yet, oh, by the way, folks, if you want to read this, you go to unknowncountry.com and input the search term COMETA, C-O-M-E-T-A, and you will find there the original article from 18 May 2001 that Leslie wrote. It is called, in our thing, Pilot Encounters with UFOs Study Challenges Secrecy and Denial.
And actually, Whitley, that's not the one. That's my second article.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I appreciate that you have it up there, but the actual Boston Globe story was 1 year before that.
Oh, okay. Let me see if
the
we
one
have
that you're
too.
Talking. Yeah, the one you're talking about, I'm happy to talk about. That was actually my second story. Is all about aviation safety issues. But the Boston Globe.
Yeah, here
and
it is. It's Leslie Keen, UFO theorists gain support abroad, and it's from 5/21/2000.
That's it, exactly. Okay. And of course, I didn't write the headline. They did.
Yeah.
So
now, Leslie's website is freedomofinfo.org, and it is well worth visiting and looking at because you can find all of this there also. You can find out more about what Leslie does and who else is involved with her and how you may be able to become involved as well. So don't miss freedomofinfo.org. Now, Leslie, let's go on a little bit because the tone of the COMETA report is similar to the tone of Nick Pope, the British Ministry of Defense UFO analyst, who recently came out and said that there are national security implications, the same thing that the COMETA report authors concluded. Now, how do you – let's get in a little bit into, as a journalist, where are you now with this? Do you feel that this is a – as close to it as you've been for all of these years, are we in some sort of danger here, or exactly what is going on that would make them say that?
Right. Well, I think that's a really important question, Whitley, because in everything I've written, and I think I forget if I put this in the Boston Globe story, but the point, and they actually made this point in the COMETA report, too, by saying that this is a national security concern, they are not suggesting that these objects are hostile or in any way want to hurt us. That's a really important point. And I've interviewed generals and other military people in other countries. They all agree with the fact that these objects are not hostile. So when they talk about national security, the main thing they're talking about is the reaction that we have to them is really what the national security problem is. There are cases, and these are in government documents, of us, not just American, but other countries, sending out planes with missiles to try and shoot these things down.
Yes.
You know about there's the Iranian case. They did this over, you know, I don't know if over Belgium they had missiles, but they weren't planning to use them. But
oh, one of the pilots who was in one of those Iranian jets is actually interviewed on Dreamland. So
that's
yes.
Right. That's fascinating. And the point being, though, that if human beings, and this is why the COMETA report titled their study, What Are We Prepared For? One of their major points was, we need to prepare our people, our air traffic controllers, and mainly our pilots and our military people about how to respond to these things. And by denying that they exist, these people aren't getting any training. And if people are trained, the accident could come, the national security problem could come through some crazy behavior on our part because we're not prepared in how to respond to these objects. So if we become hostile to them, perhaps they would try and defend themselves, and then we'd be in big trouble. But it's not to suggest that the objects have never done anything in the sky. And, you know, the abduction issue is a whole other thing, but they have never, actually there are probably some cases of planes that have disappeared, and there's some questions about that. I don't know much about that, but certainly never any cases of a UFO shooting at an American craft or any other craft. So I think it's really important not to see them as hostile, but yet we still have a national security issue here because we're unprepared in how to handle the arrival of these things. And that could be dangerous. That's really the point. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And but as far as whether or not anything has been shot down, I don't think we know the answer to that question. I was when I grew up, the former commander of the air base where Captain Thomas Mantell crashed while in pursuit of a UFO, it lived across the street. I mean, a block away, and I used to play with his son. And it was quite an interesting neighborhood. There were any number of paperclip scientists living there down on the next street. And there was a house across the street and a couple of doors down where there was an FBI guy living. And then my father, who had been in military intelligence during the war, was there. And I think they were sort of watching over this uneasy little group of people on the next street. In any case, that be that as it may, it could be that there has been more hostile response than we realize. Now,
well, I think that's possible.
It's possible because I think it would be very carefully hidden. I'm sure that the United States government hides this because of the fact that they can't control it. They are basically unwilling to speak about it because as soon as they do speak about it, then someone's going to ask, well, what about our airspace? And they're going to have to say, we have absolutely no control over this, and it won't be long before the elephant in the living room appears in the form of abductees. So they keep it hidden. Now, there is a profound disconnect involving this whole phenomenon. The beginning with the United States government denying it, the scientific community totally and completely unwilling to investigate it for what I think are essentially emotional reasons. And the press, now with a 60-year-long history of denial and debunking, I can understand where a newspaper like the Boston Globe, which has a very mixed bag about this, they've published stories on sort of both sides of the fence, might be willing to publish your story if it was well done, which they did do. But what about, like, the New York Times, which has proactively taken a stance that this, or the Washington Post, that this is all nonsense?
I know. Well, that's the interesting thing, is that I've published in many, many papers and about UFOs, but I've never, you know, I have not been covered in those, the big papers, which are the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times. No, I mean, there's only, as a freelancer, for one thing, you don't really have access to those papers. It's very difficult for a freelancer even to access the lower level papers. But, you know, and the New York Times is really close-minded on UFOs, unfortunately. And so is the Washington Post, as you say. And I think the bigger the paper and the more connected it is to sort of, you know, the establishment, because the establishment relies on these papers as sort of the authoritative voice, they're going to be less likely to take the risk to cover a subject like this than a smaller paper, which has less to lose. And the smaller papers also tend to be more concerned about, you know, they're more concerned about the actual people that live in their districts, whereas those big national papers like the New York Times, it's just a different ball game for them.
Right.
You know, and they have the science section. You know, the New York Times, every Tuesday they publish a science section. And
yes.
I remember once I wrote a story about crop circles. This was a number of years ago, in which it was pure science, and I just looked at, have there been scientific studies done on crop circles that suggest that it might be an anomaly? And the answer was yes, and I was citing, you know, this, I don't know if you've looked at the stuff on Nancy Talbot's work, but a very high-level scientist, and
yes.
I forget all his, you know, more credentials than you could ever want from this guy. He was at Dartmouth or something, and he made this incredible statement about the energy and the anomalous qualities of these crop circles based on science. And the New York Times, I tried to get it in the science section. They absolutely. I remember they made the statement, the science editor said, oh, crop circles are just like UFOs. We don't cover them.
Well, exactly. Now, let's stop right there because we've got to take a little break. We'll be right back. And when we get back, we're going to be talking about the incredibly important implications of this disconnect if the visitors, if that's what they are, change their habits. We'll be right back. This is Whitley Strieber. I'm talking to Leslie Kane. Leslie Kane is an investigative reporter with an extraordinary reputation who also reports seriously on the UFO phenomenon. We're going to be talking about her report about Governor Fife Symington of Arizona, who has recently essentially changed his stance on UFOs in a very extraordinary way, and the recent O'Hare UFO sightings, which she covered extensively. But before we go on to that, Leslie, let's talk a little bit about this cultural disconnect, because I have a journal entry up on my website called, I think it's called The Elephant in the Living Room or something to that effect, about essentially the fact that things are changing in the UFO phenomenon, mostly from our side. In that there are a number of events that have taken place recently. There have been some extraordinary UFO sightings and UFO-related events, but also some very authoritative people are coming out. Like, for example, the French government has now gone beyond the Cometa report, which was quasi-governmental, I guess I would say. They weren't a governmental body, but there were certainly many government officials involved. To actually release its entire UFO file, revealing 25% unexplained, 25% unexplained sightings. And from what I was able to see before the site became unreachable due to all the hits, hundreds upon hundreds of meticulously investigated reports. It's incredible, a treasure trove of information. It's all in French, but I read enough French to be able to have read a few of them. I might add, my French, spoken French is quite interesting. It's quite interesting to be in France with me, I think, but that's another story. Okay, let's now go on. What, do you think would happen, like to the New York Times, if the UFO phenomenon was suddenly no longer secret?
Well, you mean like if there was some dramatic event where it was unmistakable that that's what happens, or
It's unmistakable now that there is somebody here from another world. And between Paul Hellyer's disclosures, Fife Symington's statement, the French disclosures, the disclosures that recently occurred in the UK, deniability is over. There, you can't deny that there is some kind of an unknown phenomenon there. And to say now that on the part of the New York Times, we don't cover that, goes across a line to journalistic irresponsibility, because Fife Symington is a former governor of Arizona.
And don't forget, they did say that to me. It was probably in maybe 2002 or something. It was a long time ago. Whether they would still say that now, I have no idea.
Well,
and I agree with you. I mean,
that's
the
my
Governor
point.
I don't know. Maybe they will pick up the Symington story, because it's going to continue to build the story. It's not over yet. And when Out of the Blue comes out, there's going to be more, the film is going to be more of him on that. And we're working with him to get other material out, and he's going to really be involved with this now. So, I hope it'll get to a point where the New York Times will have to cover it. I agree with you. I mean, the disconnect is absolutely phenomenal, not just, in the culture that we live in about this issue. And that's what I've been bumping my head against, for 7 years now in trying to do these stories. And I'm always amazed.
Well, I think you're making progress, Leslie.
I
think you're making progress. Your story on the Fife Symington and O'Hare UFO sightings are just extraordinary and powerful stories. A lot of people are aware of these stories. Leslie, yes, you're making progress. I believe you broke the Fife Symington story, didn't you?
I did, yeah. In cooperation with the Out of the Blue team. I mean, I've worked with James Fox and Tim Coleman for years, and actually the original interview was given to James Fox by Mr. Symington for the movie Out of the Blue, which is being revised. But I, working with them, I did break the story in the print media, and I wanted to do it around the time of the anniversary. So yeah, it was extremely exciting to do, because it's a really big story, and I could certainly recognize the potential the story had.
Because
so,
Governor Symington didn't say he saw the lights, which can easily be debunked as flares. I mean, they can't actually be debunked as flares, some of them,
right.
But they have been, to the extent that it's a compromised aspect of what went on that night. However, what's not compromised and cannot be compromised is the gigantic black triangle that moved over the whole region. And this is what the governor saw.
And that's what he saw. And I think what's really important, Whitley, which most media never do, is to make a distinction, and I did this briefly in my story, and this is absolutely crucial, between the sighting of the triangle, the one you just referred to, which occurred beginning around 8:15 and maybe lasted half an hour, 45 minutes. And that was a physical giant object, without a doubt. Then, at 10 o'clock, there were these other lights that were seen. And those are the videos that we were, four videos taken,
yes,
of those lights at 10 o'clock. Those are the ones we've been seeing for 10 years on TV every time they talk about the Phoenix lights. They show this row of lights. That video does not represent the actual physical object that was seen by thousands of people earlier in the evening.
That's right.
Very separate events. And that's an issue. You know, most of the media just mucks the two up. They say, oh, the Phoenix lights could have been flares and therefore blah, blah, blah. As you just pointed out,
the 10 o'clock
lights could have been flares. They probably were, in my opinion, because Bruce McAbee did a detailed analysis of the four videos that were taken of those lights. But those are not what we're talking about when we're talking about the object and when we're talking about what Fife Symington saw. What he saw was about 2 hours earlier than those videos of those lights. So that distinction is just not made in the media, and it's infuriating, and it infuriates the witnesses that those two things get mixed up. And if, you know, what's interesting to me is I made that distinction very clearly in my story. 1 week later, the Associated Press did their version of the story, and once again, those two things were mixed up. You know, in the
AP story. You suppose it's done on purpose?
I just think they don't bother. They don't care. They don't bother to do their homework
because it's so trivial.
They just don't care. I mean, the AP, really, you know what's really interesting, Whitley? I originally tried to get my story out in the national media, you know, on Fife Symington. And eventually I published it in a paper in Arizona, which I was very happy to do because this paper has done a lot of good reporting on this. But I thought, you know, this is a huge story. I'm going to try and go national with it. So one of the places I tried was AP. I called the Associated Press Bureau in Phoenix. They're right there in Phoenix. This is a huge story. I called them on the day of the anniversary, and I said, you know, this is the 10-year anniversary today. I've got this interview with him. You want to write about it? They refused. They weren't interested. 1 week later, they write their own story on it, and it's a debunking article, basically. They basically debunked it.
60 years.
What does that tell you about journalism?
It tells you that they are committed to defending 60 years of debunking. They don't want to face the fact and say they're wrong. And this is a huge problem. Because on the other side of this, I could read to you a letter I got just the other day on the email from somebody, and it would curl your hair. I will describe this in general terms. I'm not going to read this guy's exact words. But this is typical of letters that come into this website often daily, certainly once or twice a week at least, from mm-hmm. people who are having what are clearly physical close encounters that are really very difficult for them. This is a man living at the extreme edge of anxiety with a wife and two little tiny children in his house with ample physical evidence of what is happening to him, reassurance at least from his doctor that he is not in any overt physical problems. He's had things like badly swollen groin, and has been tested and found that his testosterone level had dropped through the floor. Not the only male close encounter witness who's had that experience, and it comes back again. But the point is, there are physical signs that this man is really taking a beating, and he can't stop it. Now, the irresponsibility of the whole institutional structure, not just the press, but the government, the scientific community, and the press,
right,
is getting to the point where we can't really handle it anymore. Leslie, we got to have help here.
I know. It's true. It's true. And what, you know, and so we can do is just keep putting the pressure on. I mean, I don't know what else to do except to keep trying to get the the news out there, you know?
Well,
I've met so many people, Whitley, as have you, who have had experiences that are devastating and frightening to them. And it's a horrible tragedy, and it's just a horrible irresponsibility that the only people out there to help them are a few dedicated people such as yourself and Bud Hopkins, Dave Jacobs. Well, I mean people who actually work with the abductees, you know.
Well, somebody is here taking human sexual material. And believe me, we might get the press to the point where they are willing to admit that there are intelligent craft floating around in the sky. I don't know that we'll ever get the American press that far, but I wouldn't be surprised if the French press and the European press in general doesn't start to change its tune, but because they don't have pressure from a government.
Not like we do.
I mean, I lived with that pressure firsthand when I was working with Dr. Bill Mallow at the Southwest Research Institute. He was analyzing implants that were given to us by Dr. Roger Lear and others, and he was told in no uncertain terms by the director of the Institute, quote, our CIA client takes a dim view of Whitley Strieber and UFO research, and we do not want you to do this at all in such a way that any of the records that you expose can be identified as having come from this institution. He had to handwrite material for me. And This is because they can't control it. They know they can't.
I agree with you. They can't control it. And so what are they supposed to do, you know?
So as long as the visitors remain secretive, the government can afford to remain secretive, with the downside that the scientific community never takes advantage of the wealth of knowledge of what's happening. Like, for example, in that man's body right now, if he was exposed to the right kind of testing, we could understand almost certainly what was being done to him and why. Almost certainly.
The tragedy is, too, Whitley, is that there are researchers who would love to be able to work with this guy, but a lot of it is about people not having the funds to do the testing that's required to make do the traveling. I mean, they don't get paid.
No one gets paid.
So, you know, if somebody, this man that you mentioned, if somebody wanted to work with him and, as you suggested, do the right kinds of testing, it would require going out there, spending time with him, getting him to the right lab. All of that is very expensive.
It would be a couple of $100,000 to do the right kind of testing just on this one individual.
And I think a lot of what really holds the research back is the fact is that very simple practical reality of that there are no funds available for the people that are interested to do the work required. And that's another just a terrible, terrible situation. I mean, the scientists that are interested, and there are a handful of them, can't get the funding to do the work.
Right.
You know? I mean, they're out on their own.
They can't. No, they cannot get the funding.
And the same is true for just simple UFO investigators. And, you know, We've got to
take a little break, Leslie. Leslie Keene's website, freedomofinfo.org. Freedomofinfo.org. Get involved. Go to that website. We'll be right back. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We're talking to Leslie Keene. Her website is freedomofinfo.org. Leslie Keene is an investigative reporter who also reports seriously on the UFO phenomenon and has published her work in many mainstream newspapers and other media outlets. Leslie Keene is almost alone in this respect journalistic community. In fact, I think you might be alone.
I think I probably am in terms of somebody who actually publishes articles in the mainstream press on a consistent basis. I mean, I've been focused on this now for about 7 years, so I don't know any other journalist that's been focused on this issue exclusively and gets the stories out in the mainstream press. You know, occasionally you have a little story pop up in here or there, but it's usually a terrible story, like this recent AP piece on Symington. I mean, the Associated Press and Reuters, they do cover UFO things, but they're short and they're usually fluff pieces tinged with ridicule, and they're just... they don't give enough information. They don't give any context for it.
It's appalling. This is the most important thing that's ever happened to the human species. Without question. Absolutely.
And
look at this, what's being done.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
What? No, I just have an advantage in covering this in that I am somebody that really knows the UFO issue pretty well by now. And so, for instance, when the O'Hare story broke, and I thought that the Chicago Tribune did a very good job, John Hilkovich did a good job of laying out the facts of actually what happened that day at O'Hare Airport. What I did then was I took that story about what happened, and I put it in a bigger context, and I looked at the implications for it, and I got high-level people to comment on it. I knew who to go to for those comments.
Yes.
And that's something that another journalist just wouldn't know. So I think I have a unique role to play, and that I'm all set up to bring the best voices and the knowledge that I have and all the connections that I have to bring them into a story. And somebody like John Hilkovich, who'd never written about UFOs before, wouldn't have that background. So in that sense, I think I am in a unique position to cover this issue, and that's why I get so frustrated by these fluff pieces that come out where these people don't know anything. And they won't publish my story, but they'll go ahead and write their own fluff piece, and then that fluff piece gets picked up. AP was picked up by Fox. It was picked up by MSNBC. Everywhere. That's the story that gets picked up.
That gets picked up because they have a commitment. They don't want to be wrong. And they've been doing this for so long, it's become entrenched into the culture of the media. They are wrong. Maybe some of them even know that, but I very much doubt that because, quite frankly, I've met a lot of people in the general media, and with very few exceptions, you're not meeting the best people. They're not the strongest minds in the world. They are usually desperate, running very hard to keep their jobs, and not too likely to do anything that might cause a raised eyebrow overhead. Now, Leslie was just a moment ago referring to some of the ways that she expanded the O'Hare story, and I would just like to quote from this because it's a very important. It gives you an idea of why what she does is so important. She mentions in her story the Chicago Tribune transportation reporter John Hilkovich's statement, quote, "The witness credibility is beyond question." Now, this statement on Hilkovich's part is going to enter the culture of the media. But now, because of Leslie, so is this, quote, "The safety implications of any vehicle operating at low altitude over a major airport outside the authority of air traffic control are obvious," says NASA aviation expert Brian E. Smith, and then goes on to say, "Managers should want to hear about such vehicle operations before they become accidents or disasters." Now, that quote is what Leslie Kane does, which is so important, and which no other journalist is doing in this phenomenon.
Right, and, you know, Brian Smith is somebody who, you know, I've had in my back pocket for a number of years. I quoted him in the story that you referred to earlier about aviation safety, and he's a high-level expert on aviation safety at NASA who really sees, you know, that this is a real issue here. And that's the point I was making. Another journalist wouldn't know that Brian Smith even exists or that he is somebody that would comment on this in the way that that's really helpful. So he's been absolutely a terrific support and made great, great statements. The other one is John Callahan, who I quoted in this O'Hare piece.
Yes.
Who was the division chief of accidents and investigations for the FAA during the 80s. This is the number three, the third from the top, highest level position in all of the FAA. Extremely high level. He's a high level government official who was intimately involved with the UFO incident over Alaska in 1986 and completely sees the whole picture of how the FAA covers these things up. And he's furious about it. And I think the quotes he made, I love this quote he made, which I put in the story. You know, I point out the fact that he says that the government response to the O'Hare UFO is predictable. And then he says, this is in quotes, this is John Callahan, "The FAA will offer a host of other explanations as if wearing a blindfold. It's always something else, so it can't be what it is." And I love that quote.
That's a great quote. It's because that quote says, it says to us that this is, that ignoring this is something we really must not continue to do. Because,
exactly.
You know, I in the journal entry I referred to a few moments ago, the elephant in the living room, I make a point that the the fact that this phenomenon is itself, whoever is out there is secretive. They are. They're very stealthy.
Mm-hmm.
Means that we must not be. We must be proactively interested in what's happening to us, because something is happening to us. And its implications for the future of the human race are gigantic. The more we ignore it, the more trouble we could be getting into over the long term. The fact that they are secretive means two things. One, it means that it would be harder for them to do what they do if they weren't secretive. Two, it means that whatever they're doing is something that we would be concerned about if we understood it. I'm almost certain of that. And when you get down to what happened to me, I have vivid memories of what happened to me on that first night. Sexual material was removed from my body. This is a consistent aspect of this phenomenon, beginning, middle, and end. Now, people say, well, you know, maybe they're about to admit that there is somebody flying around here. But if there's somebody flying around here, they're going to turn out to be in our bedrooms too. And Leslie, where can you go from here? You seem to be kind of up against a media brick wall.
Well, I am, Whitley, and you think that, you know, every time I do this, you know, I always bump up against that brick wall heavily, and I make notes about it, and I observe it and see what I can learn from it, and I just keep doing it. I mean, I don't know what else to do. You know, I mean, I think that this is the role that I'm to play in this whole big issue. Everybody has a role to play, and mine is to try to, you know, publish stories that are accurate and that present, you know, intelligent information about what's going on. And I just keep bumping up my head, you know, and I think the Feinstein story is sort of an exception. It's probably, of all the stories I've done, I would have to say this is absolutely true. And without doubt, it's a bigger story in terms of the coverage that it's received since I published the initial story. You know, it was on CNN, it's been on Fox News, all of that. It's a bigger story than anything else I've done. So that part,
and yet it was very poorly handled on Fox News. I saw it. Very poorly.
I didn't see the Fox News. I'm sure it was. Did you see the CNN?
No.
Yeah, that one, I mean, it wasn't that bad, except they introduce it. You know how they always have these guys that introduce these little, it was about a 3-minute piece that they did, and then they edit it. And they have a guy, you know how they introduce the piece before it comes on? And of course, this guy was saying, he says, you know, there are many true believers out there, but now we have a true believer who's a governor. And, you know, that immediately sets the tone wrong. The point, you know, this has nothing to do with being a believer. This guy saw a physical object.
Yes.
He didn't have any beliefs necessarily one way or the other. And so they immediately set the piece up in a stupid way. So you think, oh, these guys are true. I hate the term true believer. I think it's so insulting to people. And so, you know, I was very disappointed that they started it off with that. And then, although the piece itself wasn't bad, it really wasn't, they had in the lower right-hand corner of the television screen, all during the piece where they interviewed, actually interviewed Symington on camera, they had a little graphic of a little UFO, you know, a standardized little disc.
Yeah.
Just flying around in the lower right-hand corner of the screen while this interview was going on.
You know what that was? You know what that was? That was human fear flying around there.
Exactly.
Exactly, because
they
laughter.
They have to make light of it.
They make light of it because it frightens them.
And I think that's true.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And that's why Mr. Symington said that he did not, you know, a lot of the reason he didn't talk about it initially was because he recognized the fear of
yes.
the issue. He was afraid people would panic. That's one of the reasons. It was more than that. But he was afraid people would panic if he came out and said what
and
he
yet,
was saying.
And yet, if he had come out at that news conference and said this, if he had said, I saw a large triangular object at about 8:30. It had nothing to do with any apparent flares that appeared later. And I agree that this was an unknown phenomenon. He would have changed the world. Instead, what he did was, I think, personally, morally wrong. I think that his fear that, again, fear, that this would somehow, cause panic overcame his conscience. Now I think his conscience has begun to speak more loudly. The But let me ask you this. I see an interesting pattern, and I've known for a long time that this phenomenon is in control of the situation much more deeply than we realize. Now, we have here, last year, Paul Hellyer, former Canadian Minister of Defense, makes some extraordinary statements about this. Then we have Nick Pope coming out with, and the British Ministry of Defense, with new information, including information about some very extraordinary unsolved cases. Then we have the United UFO sighting, which most people in the world believe the media is simply lying about, and the FAA is lying about.
Right, that's pretty obvious.
Pretty obvious. Then we have Fife Symington. Then we have the French opening up their entire body of UFO evidence. Now, do we have here a pattern that is being supported by the phenomenon itself that's leading toward disclosure? Do you have any sense of that at all?
I just don't know. I mean, because I don't know how to interpret the phenomenon itself. I mean, that's more your department. My department is really just to look at the facts of what's out there. In terms of, you know, whether the phenomenon is in control or what's actually going on that level, I feel I'm in no position to know anything about, really. But I think it's extremely true what you're saying, Whitley, that all these things seem to be happening at once.
Yes.
And, and it seemed like for years before that, there was really not much happening at all.
No.
Sort of a dry spell, and everybody was sort of saying, oh, ho-hum, nothing's going on. And now we have this sort of blast of very interesting developments. And, I don't know where it's going to lead. I mean, usually these things have their moment, and then they fade, you know?
Yes, that's been the pattern all along, like the Belgian incidents in 1989 were just absolutely extraordinary, and then they faded.
I suspect that will happen again, you know, unless... I just suspect it will happen again, but,
well,
you know,
it's
you never
changed,
know.
No, I think this time it's changed fundamentally. It's changed
fundamentally
in the following way. There are now a number of authoritative voices speaking out on behalf of this phenomenon in one way or another, and that has not been true before, because the number of authoritative voices, starting with Lord Hill Norton, yes, some years ago, and now adding all of this, the Cometa report and all of the recent things, it's quite a list.
I agree with you.
A huge list now, and we didn't have that basis before.
That's
now,
true. The list is accumulating, but the thing is, Lord Hill Norton's been on record for years and years and years. I've always been astounded why people don't take him, you know, why he doesn't set off a whole investigation just from his statements alone.
Well,
you know, here he is, the admiral of the fleet, you know, or whatever. I mean, such a high-level guy, and nobody... In America, anyway, nothing ever happened as a result of what he had to say, unfortunately.
Nothing did, because here's the extraordinary thing. The media doesn't believe the United States government about virtually anything it says, except this. And about they believe it everything it says, no matter how silly.
They won't question, it's true. And because they have their own issues around this, as you pointed out, there is, I think people just do not want to deal with the possibility that we could have, you know, being visited from another world. I mean, I don't think most people want to take that on. It's just too big.
Well, the average person does. The problem is that the intellectual community, the people who are empowered by the culture.
People in power, right.
But let's be specific. The people who are empowered by their position in the culture. In other words, the people whose educations and whose define their roles, the PhDs, the scientists, the journalists, the government officials, they are the ones who stand to be profoundly undercut by this. Now, back in when the Spaniards showed up in Cusco, when Pizarro showed up in Cusco, they were silenced. The advisors to the Inca emperor were silent. They fell silent when the Spaniards arrived. And this is the problem. We can't have that silence happening again. But what we are having right now is, in effect, the same silence. Denial is simply another form of that silence. We need these people. The evidence is there. The knowledge that can be gained from the evidence that's available right now is huge. But they won't look at, they won't look at it. Because it's too overwhelmingly fearful to think to themselves, we actually are not the top dogs here. Our frontier is not the real frontier. The real frontier is so far away we can't even imagine it. That's hard. Listen, we're going to take another little break. This is Whitley Strieber talking to Leslie Kane about her adventures in reporting the UFO phenomenon credibly from the standpoint of an investigative journalist. Her website, freedomofinfo.org. Don't miss it. We'll be right back. This is Whitley Strieber. We're talking to Leslie Kane. Her website, freedomofinfo.org. Don't miss it. You can also find out a lot about her work and a lot of her work, in fact, on unknowncountry.com. We publish Leslie's material whenever we get permission to do so with pride. And it is the best investigative journalism being done on the UFO phenomenon by any reporter. Richard Dolan is a scholar, and he's doing superb work also on this, but from a scholarly standpoint. And, but in terms of reporters, Leslie is far and away the leader. Now, Leslie, I want to go a little bit beyond reporting. I know it's a direction you probably don't want to go in, but do it for us anyway. I want to get your sense of the phenomenon and what you feel about it. Is it negative, positive, or mixed bag? And do the national security implications, which are obvious, represent a danger or simply something we should learn more about?
Well, I don't think they represent a danger. I mean, as you mentioned, maybe there's been a few random incidences where an accident may, we don't really know if somebody may, they may have become hostile or something, but personally, I feel, there's no question that there is a phenomenon and we can only benefit by knowing more about it. I don't feel frightened of it because what's the point? It's happening, I don't have a lot of real profound insight to offer you on this, I don't think, but, I just feel that, the average person does accept this already as real.
Yes.
And, as you pointed out, it's really the establishment that are the ones that are, preventing it from coming out, and the ones that have the most to lose and the most fear.
Yes.
So, they're coming from a different perspective than the average person is. But I kind of agree with the people I've interviewed in other countries who have studied this phenomenon, such as the Kemeti people, who don't feel that they really are any kind of a threat to us. They don't feel that way. These are military people who have studied this and have been, have had their own military planes encountering these objects. They do not feel that these flying saucers or whatever shape they take are a threat. So I'm going to accept their opinion because they've been probably the closer to this than anyone, and the pilots as well, who have had so many encounters close up with these objects. And, they don't describe them as frightening experiences, except they have a near collision. There are some cases of near collisions, but the UFOs they always avoid doing anything harmful to the airplanes.
Have you ever considered doing any investigative research work in the abductee phenomenon?
Well, I'm very interested in that phenomenon, and I have met many people who have been involved with it and who are involved with it. And the problem for me is the way I see this, is that we have to deal, it's sort of like you have to take the first step first with the,
yes,
with the people out there who are so resistant to this issue. The first step is to get people to accept that there is something in the sky and we don't know what it is. That's like nursery school level UFO 101,
right?
And I see that there's so much more to the issue than that, but I also know, and I've been advised by very sophisticated public relations people in Washington who have helped me with this stuff, that the first step is to just get people to see as I just said, that there are objects in the sky, and not even to say that they're extraterrestrial, it's just to say, my God, look what's going on in our skies, I wonder what these things are. And I have to get that point out first. And that is not, even that basic, simple truth, which you've pointed out, is so well back, absolutely irrefutable. Even
yes, and I can see where you're coming from. It makes a lot of sense.
But I have to start with that. And if I were to write about anything about, like, abduction, which these people, the people in power, which are the ones I'm trying to reach ultimately, those people can absolutely not accept that. They're just, they would just back away from this so fast.
Yes.
If I tried to talk about it.
You would have, in effect, gone a bridge too far.
Exactly, and I wouldn't be taken seriously. And the reason I have been taken seriously and I've been able to publish as well as I have is because I'm very careful about what I say, and I will only say things that, you know, I think that these people can accept, that they're so well backed up and they're not far out, you know, quotes far out, the way abductions are. I mean, you know, that's just another level. They're gonna be three times as scared of that as they're gonna be of accepting that, you know, a pilot at O'Hare Airport saw a disc. I mean, even that is hard for people to get, and that's
yes.
the level that I have to stay focused on. But it's not that I don't have a great deal of respect for the whole abduction phenomenon. I just don't feel it's my role in all of this to be focusing on that.
I
gotta play the part I've gotta play here.
I think you're absolutely right. I think you could destroy what you've built if you started to focus on that, in fact. And it's unfortunate that that's the case, but it's true. Like, for example, the man I spoke about in very general terms earlier, very general terms, I spoke about him in those general terms because who knows how it might affect his life if it was known that he came out. But I will say something about the inner phenomenon. There's an outer phenomenon, which is the UFO phenomenon, and then there's an inner phenomenon, which is the abduction and close encounter phenomenon. There are people, and this phenomenon involves the extraction of sexual material from human beings, in my opinion. And that opinion is based on a lot of knowledge and research. Now I also have a few cases where we are finding children who look very much like abductees who are not their parents, who are very, very strange children. And this is something that we're just beginning to work on. But something is being done, I feel, to manipulate the human genome, both on Earth and possibly elsewhere. I think that what we are looking at here when we look at the UFO phenomenon is we are looking at the lens on the periscope of a very big submarine that is underneath the surface of human life and human consciousness. Mm-hmm. However, I believe that it might be that it is beginning to ask us to address it as what it is. Mm-hmm. And what do you think would happen, Leslie, if, and this is a question I think you can answer, if there was an irrefutable UFO sighting event, what would happen if, say, a UFO hung over Washington for 2 hours one day, or over New York City? What would happen to the Washington Post, the New York Times, Fox News, and all of those institutions? How would they react?
I don't know, but they certainly would report it. I mean, let's say something hovered low over Washington for 2 hours. First of all, I think they would send out probably military planes, and it would either go away or the planes would shoot at it or something stupid would happen. I mean, that's what the national security danger is. I can't imagine that it could sit there for a full 2 hours without, you know, us interfering in some way, but nonetheless.
Well, I can assure you of this, that from what I know from my life in this thing, the Air Force will not shoot at it. No matter what. Especially not where the results of doing that could be witnessed.
Okay, well, I know that there have been cases where, you know, planes have been sent out armed, and if they had ever gotten close enough, who knows whether they might have tried to shoot at it. Certainly in that case over Iran, that very famous 1976 case, those pilots did attempt to fire a missile, and they weren't able to use their equipment. That's the last minute.
That's correct.
Maybe that would happen in any, you know, probably, I mean, certainly the UFOs are in control. That's no question. You know, if there was a disc, it would certainly be in control of whatever happened. So I don't know about that, but yeah, I mean, certainly if it was sitting over Washington and it was in close enough and everybody saw it for 2 hours, these papers would report it. There's no doubt.
They would be forced to report it.
They would have no choice.
Now, I wonder
I don't see why they didn't. I think the O'Hare incident, I mean, I guess this just wasn't there long enough, you know, because if it's there for 2 hours, you can bring cameras out and you can do all kinds of things.
Well, there's a slow process of acclimatization going on, and I believe that the Fife Symington story, it might be that he saw that story. And that is, who knows what inspired him, but the point is, something did. Something inspired the French now to do what they did. They didn't do it 10 years ago, 5 years ago, last year. They did it now. Something is afoot, Leslie. And I think that, I have to tell you that you're going to be in the eye of this hurricane, in my opinion, if it becomes one. If it doesn't fade again, it's going to go really, really far this time.
Let's hope it does, and I'll stay on it. But, you know, as a freelancer, again, I only have so much access to media, which is the sad thing. I mean, once something really huge happens, let's say the scenario we were just talking about, and the Post and the Times report on it themselves, you know, they're not going to – I'm not really going to be needed, quite honestly, anymore.
They're going to be reporting from – and this is the dangerous part of it – from a standpoint of such ignorance – that they're liable to be like the Inca emperor's advisors, and this thing is liable to get really way out of hand they will start to call on experts who have been denying the existence of this and not understanding it for all of their careers, who are suddenly forced to say that something strange must be going on. And whether or not that would be a great danger to this culture, I don't know, but it's a decision that won't be made here. It's a decision.
That's right. I hope that they would call on people who have knowledge to help them with the way they write their stories, you know.
Well, I hope they would call on you. A lot of them know you're out there.
But, you know, I know. But, journalists tend to be very competitive with other journalists. And who knows? I mean, this is all speculative anyway. But I would hope that they would take advantage of people that have studied this issue. And we'll see what happens. I don't know if it's a very speculative scenario.
We have been talking to Leslie Kane, investigative reporter who also reports with great expertise on the UFO phenomenon, the only reporter in the world who does this. Visit her website, freedomofinfo.org. Next up on Dreamland, Linda Moulton Howe. You're about to experience something that you just can't get elsewhere, an extraordinary Linda Moulton Howe interview about that weird, weird hexagon on Saturn. And another thing, the eye at the base of Saturn. Listen as Emmy Award-winning science reporter Linda Moulton Howe reports on the absolute leading edge of science discovery and the true mysteries of the unknown. And don't miss her website, earthfiles.com. I go there every day. It is the most exciting and most extraordinary science website in the world. It tells you the secrets and gives you the facts the others dare not. Earthfiles.com. And here she is from Albuquerque, Linda Moulton Howe.
Thanks, Whitley. Before Saturn, for the first time in astronomical history, a huge, bizarre rock out beyond Neptune has been linked to other orbiting bodies out there, like a family never seen before. Somehow, this big rock, almost the size of Pluto, got into orbit out in the Kuiper Belt, far beyond Neptune and Pluto, where most every other object is made of ice. Not only is this huge rocky object out there, it is the only object in our solar system shaped like an American football and tumbling long end over end every 4 hours. Where did this bizarre, nearly planet-sized rock come from, and what caused it to be the fastest spinning object orbiting our sun? Finally, planetary astronomer Michael Brown, Ph.D. at Caltech, says that he has discovered the smoking gun. In the March 15, 2007 journal Nature, Dr. Brown describes finding icy satellites in the EL61 region that have surface properties nearly identical to those of this big rock object called 2003 EL61. This is the first family of Kuiper Belt objects ever discovered and imply they all came from one gigantic impact long ago. The big spinning rock has never been given a real name. It's only referred to as 2003, the year it was discovered, and EL61, which is from an astronomical code list. Well, why hasn't 2003 EL61 been given a proper name yet? I talked about all of this with Professor Brown, well known for his surveys of distant objects in the Kuiper Belt beyond Neptune and Pluto. Dr. Brown was named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people of 2006. In fact, it is one of Dr. Brown's discoveries that demoted Pluto from being the ninth planet to being only one of many dwarf planets. The largest dwarf planet is Eris, discovered only 2.5 years ago. Second in size now is Pluto. And the third largest dwarf planet is the very bizarre 2003 L61 that is still challenging Dr. Brown.
This was one of the biggest surprises. We have always assumed that everything that we see out there is essentially half ice and half rock. We have actually found a few things that even have almost all ice and no rock at all. And so to find this object, when we first realized that it's almost entirely rock, that was a big surprise to us. And the strange part about it, of course, is if you look at the surface is incredibly bright and shiny and icy, and you don't see anything but ice on the surface. So it must be a very thin frosting of ice with all rock underneath. One of the original ideas that somebody came up with, just, you know, initially throwing out thoughts on how this could be, is that maybe this actually came from the asteroid belt much closer to the sun and somehow got tossed out. But the funny thing is that this is this one object is bigger than the entire asteroid belt put together. You could stuff the entire asteroid belt inside this one. All of the things, everything we learned about this as time went on, it just made it stranger and stranger. So the first thing that we realized is that it gets brighter and darker with a 2-hour period. And we realized early on that that's because it's tumbling end over end with a 4-hour period. And we see the small end, and then we see the big end, and then the small end and the big end over the course of 4 hours. So this thing is shaped almost like a football, except if you took the football and you let some air out of it and then you stepped on it, it's shaped more like that. The long dimension is about the size of Pluto, so it's a pretty big football. The short dimension is about half that size. And when we first found this, we thought this was really surprising. We didn't expect to find anything so strangely shaped, so rapidly rotating. It's the fastest rotating large object in the solar system. So all of these things were pointing to something very strange having gone on in the past.
Is there any possibility that there was some big event that affected the water on Mars and its atmosphere, the moon, the whole solar system, and may have been responsible for creating this strange 2003 EL61?
There were many large bodies in the asteroid belt, other asteroids that collided with each other, that collided with planets, things even like the body that was the size of Mars that hit the Earth that led to the moon being spun off the Earth. So those sorts of things have been well known in the inner part of the solar system for a long time. And we also know that in the outer part of the solar system, we can tell that collisions between Kuiper Belt objects must have been important. They appear to have been grinding down the objects to smaller and smaller sizes, but we just had no direct evidence. We had no smoking gun that this had ever happened until this object. The first idea that we really clung on to about how this thing got to be the shape and the rotation is that perhaps it had been larger in the past and it had been hit very hard by another large object with a sort of glancing blow. And that glancing blow would have led it to spin, and that spin itself would have pulled it out into the shape like the football. The same glancing blow could have knocked off a lot of the ice that would have been around, and it hit something that was maybe 60% of its size at a tremendous speed, many hundreds of miles an hour, slamming into it. And that gave it the energy to remove all the ice, to make it spin, to give it that crazy shape. The interesting thing that we learned, once we had the idea that that this thing had been hit, most people didn't believe the idea, because you could easily calculate the probability that such a large thing would hit another large thing, and you get something like there's one chance out of 10 million that this would happen, and that's pretty low odds. So most people sort of discarded the hypothesis. But the big new piece of data that we just came up with is that we actually found the other pieces that used to be part of 2003 EL61. We found a family of icy Kuiper belt objects that are pure ice. We have EL61, which is almost pure rock, and we have these new objects, which are almost pure ice, that are in orbits very closely related to the original 2003 EL61 orbit. So it was definitely the smoking gun that these objects had all really once been part of the same object. So now that we know that this impact happened, we can start to watch where the objects have gone since the impact. Since the impact has occurred, most of the objects have stayed more or less in the same place that it happened. EL61 itself, the big rapidly rotating body, has moved slightly. And the reason it's moved slightly is because of many, many long-term, long-range interactions, gravitational interactions with Neptune. It's sort of halfway through its evolution, and when it gets to the end stage it actually will encounter Neptune. And once it encounters Neptune, it's on a one-way journey into Jupiter. And then Jupiter is sort of the goalkeeper of the inner solar system. If Jupiter lets it go by, it becomes a comet. If Jupiter doesn't let it go by, it just flings it out of the solar system entirely. So EL61 itself will go down this path and has the potential to become a spectacularly bright comet.
And would it continue to have its football shape and be moving end over end as it became a comet flung by Jupiter?
It would. It would be an interesting sight because you would get these jets coming off of it that were, you know, like a yard sprinkler that's with the jets coming in. Imagine the yard sprinkler moving incredibly quickly. You'd get these really variable jets going in different directions. I sort of vaguely calculated that it would be as bright as the full moon for decades at a time. It would be a pretty spectacular sight if you're willing to wait a billion years for when it happens.
So you think it's 1 billion years it might turn into this over-end comet?
That's right.
And why is it that it would take a billion years?
Well, it's very slowly evolving, and it's already been doing it for 4.5 billion years. It has a little bit more to go before it ever gets to encounter Neptune. It's because it only gets a tiny little tug from Neptune every time it goes around the sun, and you have to add up those tiny tugs before you have enough of an effect to get close enough to really change your orbit dramatically.
And if you add the icy pieces that you have found plus the big rocky football and you put them together, that would be larger than Pluto?
No, it's about two-thirds of the size of Pluto. It's not quite larger than Pluto.
And when is it going to get a name?
That is an excellent question. I don't know the answer to that. We submitted a name 6 months ago now to the International Astronomical Union, and the International Astronomical Union has not said a word. So we don't know.
And you can't even talk about the name you've submitted?
I can at least tell you that the name itself that we submitted is from Hawaiian mythology. It's a name for both the main object, the two moons that go around it, and for the entire family all go together. So it's a nice combination. We hope they accept it, but they have been a little bit slow.
But why would they not just name this large object?
It is because it's a sordid story. It's because this is the object that most people don't remember, luckily, but 2.5 years ago when we first announced the existence of the large object of Eris, the one bigger than Pluto, the day before another group had announced the existence of this other object, and in fact it was 2003 EL61. We thought that they had legitimately discovered it, so we supported their discovery and we supported them as the discoverers, even though we had actually discovered it ourselves earlier. We hadn't announced the discovery. And the way science works, I think rightly so, is that whoever announces the discovery first is the one who actually officially gets to be the discoverer. But we learned later that they hadn't actually discovered it. They had only discovered our website that told where it was. Their claims had been essentially fraudulent, as far as we can tell. However, the International Astronomical Union hasn't decided who to side with yet at this point. So the announcement of the name will essentially tell you who they believe.
And do you expect that to happen any time this year?
I have zero idea.
Beyond Pluto now, what is the largest object in the solar system out there beyond Neptune?
That's still Eris. Eris, the one that we discovered a little more than 2 years ago. It's the one that caused poor Pluto to get demoted.
And it is how much bigger than Pluto?
Not much bigger. It's actually only about 5% bigger than Pluto. It's about 25% more massive than Pluto. It's clearly heavier, although just barely bigger.
And is it all ice or ice and rock?
No, it's like Pluto. It's about half ice and half rock.
Is Aries defined as a planet or as a Kuiper Belt object?
Definitely Kuiper Belt object. I mean, the current definition puts it as puts both Pluto and Eris as dwarf planets, and I think that's a very good place for them. Dwarf planets who are members of the Kuiper Belt.
And what is the main distinction now between a dwarf planet and one of the main planets?
Just purely size. It's a combination of size and whether you reside in one of these belts. Things in the asteroid belt, things in the Kuiper Belt are not legitimate planets. Large objects that are outside these belts are planets.
What are you working on now that excites you the most?
We are continuing. We're looking for more of these very distant, very large objects. And the hope is that we've really just hit the tip of the iceberg and we'll continue to find more.
And you think that there would be other objects out in the Kuiper Belt and beyond that would be as large or larger than Pluto?
Not in the Kuiper Belt, but definitely beyond the Kuiper Belt. So that's where we're looking now.
And you want to try to find them because?
For two big reasons. One is that by finding these things that are left over from the creation of the solar system, we are learning about what was there back when the solar system formed and where it was. And two is that these are the big ones are the ones that we can study in the most detail. So we're learning more about the processes that are involved in making a large icy planet-sized thing and what happens geologically.
I thought that I would fill in some of the gaps that Professor Brown politely left out about the dispute over 2003 EL61's discovery. 4 years ago, Dr. Brown and his team had been observing the strange object for 6 months, trying to better understand EL61's odd shape and the rapid rotation before announcing their find. And then suddenly, astronomers at the Sierra Nevada Observatory in Spain, led by José Luis Ortiz Moreno, claimed EL61 was their discovery. However, further investigation showed that a website containing archives of where the Brown team telescopes had been pointed while tracking 2003 EL61 had been accessed 8 times in the 3 days preceding Ortiz Moreno's announcement. Further, computers with IP addresses were traced back to the website of the Institute of Astrophysics in Andalusia, Spain, where Ortiz Moreno works. That was a week after Professor Brown had published an abstract for an upcoming conference at which he had planned to announce the discovery of 2003 EL61. Dr. Brown's abstract referred to 2003 EL61 by a code which was the same code used in the online telescope logs. It was learned that the Andalusia computers had accessed those telescope logs containing that code directly instead of through Dr. Brown's research homepage. When Ortiz Moreno was asked about his online activity, Ortiz emailed back to Dr. Brown that the professor was, quote, hiding objects, unquote, and that, quote, the only reason why we are now exchanging email is because you did not report your object, unquote. As Dr. Brown has pointed out, such an accusation contradicts the accepted scientific practice of analyzing one's research until there is some confidence that data is accurate and then submitting it for peer review prior to any public announcement. And the big rock was so bizarre that Dr. Brown and his team wanted to be extremely careful before they made their announcement. Although the matter has not yet been settled, Professor Brown has petitioned the International Astronomical Union to credit his team rather than Ortiz Moreno as the discoverers of 2003 EL61. At least one authority within the IAU has indicated that Dr. Brown's team will end up being recognized as the discoverers, and the strange spinning football out there will finally have a name beyond numbers and letters. Now, as if our solar system could not be more strange, Saturn continues to amaze everyone. It was only a few months ago that the Cassini spacecraft photographed the ring planet South Pole, which looks like a huge eye staring out into space. And that is thought to be shaped by waves of south polar winds. In the past 6 months, for the first time since Voyager's flybys of Saturn in the early 1980s, Saturn's North Pole has been clearly seen in both visual and infrared spectrometry. There, in all of its baffling glory, is a six-sided hexagon nearly 15,000 miles across and 60 miles deep, apparently created by north polar winds that have been blowing in this hexagonal shape for at least two decades. Saturn's North Pole hexagon is so big that nearly four planet Earths could fit inside. Kevin Baines, Ph.D. and atmospheric physicist with Cassini's visual and infrared mapping spectrometer team at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, told reporters earlier this week, quote, "This is a very strange feature lying in a precise geometric fashion with six nearly equally straight sides. We've never seen anything like this on any other planet. Indeed, Saturn's thick atmosphere, where circle-shaped waves dominate, is perhaps the last place that you would expect to see such a six-sided geometric figure. And yet, there it is," unquote. You can see images from Dr. Brown's 2003 EL61 research in my Earth Files report. There's a hot link from the headlines page at www.earthfiles.com. And I also have hot links to a series of Saturn North Pole hexagons taken in both visual and infrared frequencies. As Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman once said, quote, "Not only is the universe stranger than you can imagine, it is stranger than you can imagine," unquote. And Whitley, with these constant discoveries that keep challenging scientists who think they've seen everything, I am so excited about what more is going to be around the corner in the next few months.
That's for sure, Linda. And not only that, I go to the very large array telescopes that are being created around the world now in Peru and also in the United States, I believe, that are going to be 100 times more powerful than Hubble and from the ground, meaning that if we are looking at stars like 18 Scorpius, which is an identical twin of the sun about 50 light years away, we are going to be able to clearly see any stony planets around it, directly see them. And I wonder if we will ever see one that's blue.
Yes. And with that issue of water, it is amazing to me that one of the dominant interests of planetary scientists and astronomers like Dr. Brown is all of this ice that is out of...
Linda, we've got just seconds left, so I'm going to have to say goodbye. Thank you so much. We'll be talking to you again.